When the light bulb goes on in your brain, you can see it.
There is a burst of activity, of high-frequency electrical activity in the brain at that moment when the idea pops into awareness.
Quantifying the Eureka moment. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I think cure is our new favorite word. If you poke them and they don't move, then we figure they're pretty much anesthetized.
Throw them in a blender, and then what you have in the blender is a big soup full of all sorts of plant material, but also this virus we're interested in.
The Descoby is a disgusting gelatinous blob that looks like a weird alien that you would not want anywhere near your food.
Well, I hope you remember that we had at least a brief discussion in the recovery area immediately after this.
That's kind of what we're trying to fix by putting it right on your face.
Failure is actually just part of the process.
And I remember
generally,
and then that was it.
Today's show is about great moments, life-changing moments, and moments that offered new insights into age-old questions. But first up, aha moments. Scientific discoveries are often fueled by these sudden insights, eureka moments, when that light bulb is going off in your head. And this first story is literally about a light bulb of the blue LED variety. Here's what happened, and I have to tell you, this is one of my all-time favorite Pulse stories. In 2014, a group of Japanese researchers won a Nobel Prize for developing blue LED lights. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, the group that selects the Nobel Prize winner for physics, declared that the 21st century will be lit by LED lamps, and the Academy marveled that this technology was only two decades old. Hold on a minute, thought Benjamin Gross.
I knew for a fact that wasn't the case. I had held an LED that was older than that in my hands.
Gross is the curator of the Sarnoff Collection, and I'll let reporter Todd Bookman take it from there.
It's a small museum dedicated to electronics and broadcasting equipment on the campus of the College of New Jersey. One of the pieces housed here is that old LED. It was made in Princeton, inside the laboratories of RCA.
RCA in the 1960s was the leader in consumer electronics in the United States, and one of the things that its chairman, David Sarnoff, really wanted was to create a television that could hang on the wall like a painting.
It's kind of amazing that they were thinking of flat-screen TVs 50 years ago, but to make it a reality, engineers first had to produce three different color diodes.
Red and green ones had been developed in the early 1960s, but blue, for a variety of reasons, turned out to be more complicated.
In 1972, a working prototype finally arrived, apparently unbeknownst to the Nobel people. It's still pretty much in its original form.
It's mounted into a small gray box. How big would you say this is, Jonathan?
I would say that it's about 2.5 by 5 inches.
Jonathan, by the way, is Jonathan Allen. He's a retired physicist who volunteers at the Sarnoff, helping to keep the old equipment up and running.
And the box has a few toggle switches. It looks like there are two toggle switches on the top and one on the side. And there's a little dial here.
Dial adjusts the current that you put through the light-emitting diode.
So picture this little light bulb connected by two wires to the top of the box. It's technically a compound semiconductor, a material called gallium nitride.
There's a tiny white crystal, and that crystal is the gallium nitride, and that's going to glow, if all goes according to plan, that's going to be the thing that glows blue.
That's right. We're going to see if this 40-year-old device still works. Jonathan hooks up a voltage meter to the antique battery on the underside of the box.
Son of a gun. It actually has some poop.
How much voltage are we
talking about? We've got 20 volts.
That's not bad.
Having poop is apparently engineering speak for power. I didn't ask.
I think we're ready if we want to try getting started. We can call Herb Maruska and see if we can get this LED lit.
Maruska, this is the guy who was working at RCA in the early 1970s and actually built this thing, the first working blue LED. He's still around, retired, and living in Florida. Over a speakerphone, he urges the team to be cautious.
Yeah, there's only one, so you gotta be careful.
There's only one, right, so double-check the connections and turn it up very slowly.
Oh, yeah, black to black, red to red. Yep. All right, here we go. Anything?
Not yet, no.
Let's recheck the plugs.
It isn't the plugs. Turns out it's the lack of poop in the old battery. They reroute to another power source, turn the dial, and...
Yes, we're drawing current. We are drawing current. We've got a couple of milliamps here.
We got it.
It's lighting faintly.
We've got blue. It's glowing.
It's glowing
that
blue.
That is definitely blue. Yep. That is beautiful.
Yep, we've got 3 milliamps.
That is amazing.
You want it?
After all these years.
You want me to give any more poop you want me to give it?
No, don't over-poop it.
These guys are over the moon. This little blue light, this artifact from the tail end of the golden age of American technology, still fires. Maruska told me that just as he completed this work in the early 1970s, RCA's empire began to crumble. His entire department was scrapped. Some Japanese researchers picked up the project, and by the early 90s, they had built stable, efficient blue LEDs, the lighting that is changing the way we see. It's that accomplishment that earned the Nobel Prize. But Benjamin Gross hopes the whole story, this American story, gets told.
And it all starts here. It all starts in New Jersey, in the Delaware Valley, at RCA.
For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
You're listening to The Pulse, and now onto that light bulb going on in our heads. Drexel University psychology professor John Cunyos explores that phenomenon in his new book, The Eureka Factor: Aha Moments, Creative Insight, and the Brain, and he joins us now to talk about it. John, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, we trace the original Eureka moment back to Archimedes, who is said to have shouted the word as he jumped from his tub to announce his latest discovery. What are some other really famous Eureka moments?
Well, probably the second most famous one is that of Isaac Newton, who, according to legend, was sitting under an apple tree. An apple fell and hit him in the head, and he suddenly had the idea for a theory of gravity. The part about the apple hitting him in the head is apparently not true. What Isaac Newton himself said, that he was walking in the garden and he saw an apple fall and he had the idea for the theory of gravity. And that, I'd say that's probably the second most famous one.
You describe in the book an aha moment that led to the creation of WALL-E. Talk about that.
Yes. Andrew Stanton, who's responsible for so many of the Pixar hits, he was working on making the movie WALL-E, and he couldn't think of how WALL-E's face should look. And he was really struggling with this idea. And he figured he'd take a break, and he went to a baseball game. And he didn't have a very good seat. And he asked the person next to him to borrow their binoculars. And the person handed the binoculars the wrong way. And when he held the binoculars up with the wrong side towards him, he had this sudden insight that that would be the face of WALL-E. He said the idea just dropped into his lap that WALL-E would be, quote, a binocular on a stick.
And we often describe these moments like things clicking into place or a light bulb going off. It almost seems like we should see a little explosion in our brain at that moment.
Well, in fact, at that moment, our EEG studies, electroencephalogram studies, show there is a burst of activity, of high-frequency electrical activity in the brain at that moment when the idea pops into awareness. And we, in our studies, we've shown this occurs in an area of the right hemisphere, the right temporal lobe, just above the right ear. So yes, there is sort of a little explosion of activity.
How have we as humans deconstructed the aha moment or tried to perhaps break it down to its scientific components?
Only very recently have scientists started looking at these aha moments. Psychologists call them insights, and tried to understand where they come from. About 100 years ago, the German Gestalt psychologist looked at insight and made an analogy to perception. You can look at an object, and you can see it in a particular way. But with a shift of attention, you can see it as something else. So you look at a brick, and you could see that brick as a building block for a house. But if you shift your attention and think of it in a different way, you can think of it as a doorstop, as a nutcracker, as almost anything, as a weapon. Similarly, problems, when you encounter a problem, you might find it insoluble. And then something snaps, something clicks, and you realize that you're looking at the problem all wrong. And when you see it in the right way, when you see it in a new light, then the solution seems simple. And it was at that point that scientists started constructing puzzles and problems that people could only solve with these shifts of attention that lead to sudden insights, these aha moments.
Can we make these aha moments happen in our brain? We're often told, you know, if you're stuck with a problem, go for a walk, do something else.
Well, research has shown that there are a number of factors that can make it more likely for you to have an insight. One is to be in a positive mood. When a person's in a positive mood, Brain imaging studies show that an area in the middle of the front of the brain called the anterior cingulate lights up, and that allows you to expand the scope of your thought. It allows you to consider remote possibilities, sort of long-shot ideas, the stuff of creativity, the stuff of sudden insights. But when you're in a slightly negative mood, say you're a little bit anxious, that's like putting on mental blinders. You focus on the here and now. You focus on one or two obvious possibilities, and you're good at analytical thinking, but not so good at creative thought. So one thing is positive mood. Another thing is sleep, lots and lots of sleep. Sleep is a very powerful inducer of insights. It actually restructures your knowledge to bring out details and hidden relationships, which are the stuff of insight.
Is there any kind of eureka brain? Are there people who just are more prone to having these great insights than others?
We like to think of creativity and creative insight as being something like a person's weight. So, for example, your weight has a set point. That's determined by genetics, that, you know, all things being equal, your weight will gravitate towards a certain value. But you can do things to raise or lower that set point. Creativity is probably something like that. I think we're genetically set to have a particular cognitive style. Some people are more creative, some people are more analytic. But that doesn't mean that the environment and things you do can't slide you around on that scale one way or the other.
John, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
John Cunhos is a professor of psychology at Drexel University, and together with Mark Beeman, he has written The Eureka Factor. When Cunhos and I talked about making aha moments happen, we stuck with factors like mood or sleep or stepping away from a problem for a while. But researchers are exploring another option, kind of hacking our brains to make creative thinking happen through brain stimulation. Let's listen back to contributor Avir Mitra as he was getting his brain hotwired.
Are you my subject?
Yes.
Okay, great. So if you could have a seat right here.
Okay.
I'm a subject in a science
sure.
experiment.
So the first thing I'm doing is putting these pads in saline solution. That's just going to help conduct the current.
This is graduate student Lisa Muzz.
And really, the wetter, the better. You don't want any kind of burning.
But this isn't your everyday science experiment.
TDCS isn't dangerous at all, but you are putting an electrical current on the scalp.
That's because this experiment involves sending an electric current through my brain.
I'm not going to lie, I'm nervous. I'm like, okay, electrical current going through my brain.
So are we ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
I'm at the University of Pennsylvania with cognitive psychologist Sharon Thompson-Schill. She's interested in the part of the brain right under your forehead, the frontal lobe.
So my group has been studying the function of the frontal lobes of the human brain for a couple of decades now. And the best way to describe the frontal lobes is that they're a lot like a CEO of a company, strategy, goal setting, goal following, things like that. They help filter information. Our frontal lobes help us prioritize what we're going to pay attention to in the world, what we're going to think about, what we're not going to think about.
Having mature frontal lobes are a huge part of what makes us human. It's the major reason we're able to control our impulses, plan our actions, filter out all the distractions, and basically not punch people in the face every time they annoy us.
And that is obviously good. So it's really good to have a CEO of a company. It's really good to have a central executive of your brain. Our interest that motivated this study was in whether there are advantages to having an immature frontal lobe.
Could it be that the frontal lobes hinder our ability to be creative? I mean, if you think about it, creativity requires a certain impulsivity. You can't be afraid of sounding crazy. You can't filter what comes in or out. You just have to let go. And having a CEO watching your every move might make that tough.
So one idea we have, and this is really we're in uncharted territory here, when you have to think outside the box, one of the things you have to do is turn off the normal tendency you have to quickly categorize everything as a particular object with a particular purpose.
In other words, you need to turn down the frontal lobes. A quick and easy way to do that is to flood them with an electric current and temporarily shut them down. This technique is called TDCS, and that's why Lisa was taping electrodes to my skull.
Let's turn down the left frontal cortex, and we think then it's going to turn down your tendency to categorize things, and that's going to then free you to think more creatively.
Which brings us back to Dr. Thompson-Schill's experiment. She divided participants into groups. Some had the TDCS going through their prefrontal cortex, and some had a fake electrode with no current at all. She showed them a common object and asked them to name the common use for them. For example, an ironing board is to iron clothes. As you'd expect, everyone did well on that across the board. But then, she asked them to come up with an uncommon use, something unique you could do with that object. Here I am running through the experiment.
Baseball bat. A crutch. You can use it as a crutch.
I should mention that the TDCS current you can hear in the background, it doesn't hurt, but it does feel strange. Kind of like licking a 9-volt battery. It even messed with the sounds of my microphone.
Screwdriver.
It was surprisingly hard.
Toothpick. Probably not, but...
They measured two things.
One was how long it took the participants to come up with a response, and the second was how many times they failed to come up with the response.
And here's where the frontal lobe, specifically the left prefrontal cortex, showed itself. The results showed that dialing down the prefrontal cortex actually made it easier to come up with a unique use for an object.
We were able to cut that failure rate in half, and we shaved a full second off that response time for the stimulated subjects.
So temporarily drowning the CEO actually freed up the brain to be more creative.
What about, I mean, I'm just picturing some day in the not too distant future where we could have a boardroom meeting where we all put on these helmets and, you know.
So I just like to be careful. This is what scientists do in making really clear that there's just this one particular aspect of creative cognition that I'm talking about. That being said, there
Which is the ability to think outside of the box.
That's right. And to not be so fixated on one particular learned association or learned categorization that you have.
Pulse contributor Avir Mitra visiting the brain lab of Sharon Thompson Schill. Coming up, moments when you go, hold on, why is this happening?
So I definitely hear something that's not normal. Possibly a...
More favorite Pulse moments coming your way. You're listening to WHYY. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at ibx.com and rideindigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca, offering resources to help patients afford and access their medicines. The AZ and Me patient assistance programs provided more than 382,000 patients in the U.S. with more than $670 million in savings in 2014. AstraZeneca Direct offers a range of patient support services, including delivery of brand-name prescription medications directly to a person's home. More at AstraZeneca-US.com.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're listening to some of our favorite moments from the show today. Here's something we've been calling a tomato juice moment, named after our most popular story ever, which explored why people drink tomato juice on planes but not on the ground. So a tomato juice moment is where you realize that something strange or interesting or potentially worrisome is happening, but you've never given it a second thought until you do. And then you want to find out more. For me, it was the scrubs that got me, because living in a city with so many hospitals, I see people in scrubs all over the place, walking down the street, on the subway, in the coffee shop. And I wondered, is that safe? Or are they getting MRSA into my coffee? Should scrubs be worn outside of the hospital? So I decided to explore this, starting on Walnut Street in Philadelphia. I see you're wearing scrubs. Do you wear them when you go to work?
Yes.
So you take them home and then you wear them to work, and when you leave?
I wash them. And right. I mean, it depends if I'm in a rush or not.
Your hospital doesn't have a policy about not wearing scrubs outside, right?
They do. You're really not supposed to. Oh.
But they don't say anything when you arrive in your scrubs?
Mm-mm. No.
How come?
I don't know.
So nobody's ever said to you, don't wear these scrubs outside?
To me personally, no.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi. I see that you are wearing scrubs.
Today I didn't feel like dressing up, so I'm dressed in my pajamas, yes.
Are you concerned at all that that might pose a risk for infection or anything like that?
Not today, because I'm not doing any procedures today, so I'm just seeing patients like I would be wearing my ordinary clothes, so no.
I'm literally just walking one block coming in.
So where are you going right now?
Wawa.
Scrubs also go to Starbucks, to the movie theater, to restaurants, the subway. And all biologist Jonathan Eisen of UC Davis can see is traveling germs. Before we get into his reasons, a clarification.
Actually, I work hard against spreading germophobia.
Eisen is not a germaphobe. Germs are his life. He studies microbes, the good, the harmless, and the terrifying.
There's been a very rapid and scary increase in the abundance and frequency of infections from antibiotic-resistant bacteria, for example. And one place that we see a much higher frequency of those organisms is in medical care facilities, not surprisingly. That's where people go when they're sick, and there's also spread of these organisms inside medical facilities.
Eisen says the biggest concern with scrubs outside of the hospital is not so much bringing germs in, but carrying them out.
They actually get contaminated relatively quickly, so if you bring in a pair of new scrubs or new clothing of any type within, you know, 6 to 8 hours, they can get a reasonable number of microbes on them. That's not surprising. And of course, if there are antibiotic-resistant microbes in that environment, they will also pick those up. So the thing that we don't know a lot about is whether or not going outside the hospital after they have gotten contaminated causes any transmission of those microbes to other people.
So scrubs may collect lots of germs, but we don't know if that actually causes any problems.
There's really limited evidence, lack of data on the role of attire and the role of scrub attire in the transmission of organisms in healthcare settings.
That's Julia Sammons. She's medical director of the Department of Infection Prevention and Control at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
So I think until robust evidence exists or more robust clinical studies are done, our priority is really on focusing on evidence-based practices that include hand hygiene, the isolation of patients with communicable diseases, disinfection and cleaning of the environment, these things which have strong evidence behind them as reducing the spread of germs in hospitals.
I guess this bag I brought here when I take it back out could be just as germ-laden as a pair of scrubs, right?
So I think, you know, if you were to culture a number of different surfaces, whether it's clothing or surfaces in the environment, you may find germs on them. I think it's most important to remember in the healthcare setting, the primary way germs are transmitted are through our hands.
Salmon says CHOP only has specific policies when it comes to operating room scrubs and areas of the hospital where instruments are sterilized. Scrubs worn there cannot leave the hospital. But that's it.
As a general employee outside of the operating room setting, scrubs can be worn just like other clothing as sort of part of a uniform. Again, the general standard is that scrubs should be clean, and if they become visibly soiled or contaminated, they need to be removed and fresh clothing be put on in their place.
The American Hospital Association has no guidelines on this topic. All of the area hospitals I contacted seem to have scrub policies like the one at CHOP. Firm rules only apply to OR scrubs and some other specific areas of the hospital. It seems right now hospitals are focusing on areas where they know germs are being transmitted, like hands, and scrubs are simply not a priority. That irks biologist Jonathan Eisen.
So there's this big surface area, and it just seems as a precautionary principle that hospital and medical workers should try to do the simple things that can limit the possibility of spreading some organisms that you don't want to have spread. And it just seems that bringing scrubs outside of the hospital doesn't make sense as a common practice.
And that's what happens when you explore this kind of question. You get more questions, like what about shoes worn in hospitals, or ties, or white coats? Good thing we got a weekly show. We can explore all of this stuff. No, I don't want your number.
We're listening to some of our favorite Pulse moments today, and right now we're exploring the moment where you look at something and you suddenly wonder, why is that happening? For example, why do we love round numbers? We rejoice when we've lost 10 pounds, but not at 9 pounds. We stay on our bike just a little bit longer to complete a 20-mile ride because somehow stopping at 19 and a half miles would feel like a cop-out. Pulse contributor Christopher Intagliata explores.
One way to answer that question would be to bring in a numbers guy.
I think a lot of people don't know that number theory is still going on. They think the problems were all solved a long time ago by dudes in robes.
This is Jordan Ellenberg, not a dude in a robe. He is a number theorist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
In many ways, it's completely arbitrary, right?
More than being a numbers question, what a lot of this really boils down to is human psychology, how we're built.
Quantifying is one of the fundamental human activities. We've done it in every civilization that we've ever had. It's kind of like music or something, right? It's not even clear we would really be human without doing it. It's just one of the fundamental ways we apprehend our world.
And we're not talking just any old numbers. We like round numbers. All those zeros, they're like a breath of fresh air.
We like things that are simple, that are easy to process, that are easy to make sense of, that are easy to understand.
Adam Alter is a professor of marketing and psychology at New York University. And one of the things he's studied is the meaningfulness of round numbers.
They're great guideposts if you're looking at goals, for example, if you're aiming for something, to lose a certain amount of weight, to run a marathon at a certain pace. Those round numbers serve as very salient goals. They're very powerful, they're very visible, and they're easy to recall and remember. And so I think they are useful for all those reasons.
Round numbers rule our lives in a whole lot of ways. SAT takers, for example, are more likely to retake the test if they fall just short of a round number. And don't forget the all-important batting average in baseball. Major league players are four times as likely to end the season with a 300 batting average.
That's a big 300 batting average.
Than a 299. That's not a coincidence. It's because batters just under 300 almost never walk on their last at bat. They go for the base hit.
Line drive, base hit, there it is.
And batters who've already achieved 300, much more likely to send in a pinch hitter.
Pinch hitter extraordinaire, John Vanderwalla.
Remember, 300, it's just a number. But it actually changes the player's behavior. And in case you're wondering, even number theorists like Ellenberg aren't immune to the charms of a round number.
I can't deny that I have in my mind the idea of the 300 hitter. I may know that that number is a meaningless and arbitrary benchmark, but I can't deny it has a certain force with me. And if I live to be 100, I'm sure I'm going to get myself like a really, really big cake, even though I know it's arbitrary.
But hey, you probably don't need fancy research to tell you round numbers are important. You use them all the time in your own life, right? Estimating expenses, negotiating your salary, and talking about your age.
We talk about being in our 30s and our 40s and our 50s. We don't talk about being in our 30-70s.
This is mathematician Eugenia Chang, scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago.
It's very intimately linked to the fact that we have 10 fingers.
10 fingers and 10 toes.
Probably because we have 10 fingers, so...
Yeah, heard that answer a lot. That the reason we ended up with the base 10 system, the decimal system, is basically an evolutionary accident. After all, we do learn to count on our fingers, our digits. And I'll get back to counting on fingers a little later. But the point is, counting in ones, tens, hundreds, thousands comes so natural to us now that it's easy to forget there are alternatives.
There's a popular mathematical game that you play where you imagine that you're on an alien planet where the aliens only have, say, 7 fingers.
And then, of course, you end up with a base 7 system. But no need to even make up aliens to imagine different number systems. Just go back 5,000 years to the Sumerians. They developed a sexagesimal system, base 60, which they later passed on to the Babylonians. 60 minutes, 60 seconds, 360 degrees, that all comes from the Babylonians. Their numbers still hang out in the shadows of our modern number system. And I said I'd come back to counting on fingers, because I wanted to mention that ending up with base 10, because we have 10 fingers, isn't really the only way things could have turned out. Some cultures in the Middle East and Asia actually count to 12 on each hand. If you look at your palm, this will be easier to explain. Using the thumb as a pointer, just count each of the three little bones on each of your fingers. Pinky, ring, middle, index, and bingo, 12. Base 12 may even predate the Sumerians. And like base 60, there's still bits of base 12 fossilized in our modern world. A dozen. 12 inches. 12 hours. And here's the thing. Even though we ended up with 10, to mathematicians, 12 is much more attractive.
In base 12, you can divide numbers by 2, 3, 4, and 6 quite easily, because 12 divides by 2, 3, 4, and 6.
Mathematician Ian Stewart of the University of Warwick in the UK. He says, from a practical standpoint, 10 is actually kind of lousy.
We still sell eggs by the dozen. And if you've got 12 eggs, you can divide them equally between 2 people, 3 people, 4 people, or 6 people. You can't do it with 5. 10's not as good. If you've got 10 eggs, you can divide them between 2 people or 5, but not 3, not 4.
12 works so much better, and its clean divisions are so beautiful, so tempting, that some people actually think our society would be better off if we converted to base 12, the duodecimal or dozenal system. These people call themselves dozenalists, and they have their own conferences and organizations, like the Dozenal Society of America. Don Goodman is the president and an attorney by day. Does he think we're switching over anytime soon?
I think it's pretty unlikely, I'll say that. But I think what's more important is to get people thinking about these things. Thinking about mathematics in non-decimal bases can really enhance one's understanding of what numbers are and how they work.
For The Pulse, I'm Christopher Intagliata.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. How many times has a doctor put a stethoscope on your chest? Probably quite a few times. Have you ever wondered what exactly they are listening for and what it takes to detect a problem? After you hear this story by Tanya English, I promise you'll experience your next checkup with a new appreciation for that skill.
When the doctor places that cold stethoscope on your chest, she's listening for two distinct sounds.
Lub-dub, lub-dub. Loved up. You can almost set your clock to what you're hearing. They are clear, they are crisp, and they are regular.
Marianne Kuzma teaches the science of hearing heart sounds at Drexel University College of Medicine. That skill is called auscultation.
So you can auscultate the heart, you can auscultate the lungs, you can auscultate the abdomen. It's just using the stethoscope to hear something.
The heart pumps oxygen-rich blood to the rest of the body.
Brain, kidney, muscles are supplied by the left side of the heart.
As the heart muscle fills and relaxes, blood flows through the chambers and valves keep the blood flowing in the right direction.
So think about the garden hose. You got a big fat hose that you're trying to squeeze the water through, no problem.
So the lub sound is one valve closing and the dub sound is a different valve shutting off. But if a valve is unhealthy, say it's thick or calcified, it doesn't close properly. It's kind of like pinching off that garden hose.
It's going to have higher pressures and you're going to have higher sounds.
Medical students train to hear those changes as a clue to heart trouble.
Listen to a fourth heart sound. I will begin with three normal beats and then add the fourth heart sound.
There's an extra sound that interrupts the usual cadence.
It sounds like a stone skipping a blum-blum, blum-blum, dun. And so that is, we often say that's similar to the word Tennessee, where if you think about the first two syllables of Tennessee, we roll them together, tenna, and that's what you're hearing. As you're listening to the sound, think of the word Tennessee.
It's all about pattern recognition and proper stethoscope placement.
So underneath your second rib on your right side, it's about right here. You feel where I'm pointing to? A little lower than your collarbone. And then you go to your left side.
25-year-old medical student Angelica Johnson is finally getting to see patients after 2 years of book work.
So you always do a cardiac exam, no matter what. That's just something that just occurs. You could tell me that your toe hurts. I'm going to listen to your heart.
The third-year student learned her technique by listening to heart sounds and training exercises on her commute from West Philly.
Next stop, 38th Street.
So I would download it and just listen to it on the Scepter ride to school. Keep repeating and repeating and repeating it.
Drexel professors say it can take up to 500 repetitions before students can consistently identify the whooshes and murmurs that suggest a problem. To practice, Johnson also paints pictures of the sounds in her mind, one murmur called an aortic stenosis. Slowly gets louder, comes to a peak, then slowly gets softer.
So it goes up and then it comes down. It's like a diamond-shaped murmur.
Another third year, Matthew Diamond, he says for him, it helps to tap the rhythm with his fingers as he listens to the simulated heartbeats.
Lub-dub-dub or lub-lub-dub.
It's trickier to notice those sounds in a breathing, squirming person, but dedication pays off. A patient came in for a regular checkup. Diamond heard a strange muffle and sent the patient for an ultrasound.
And it turns out that that patient had massive PEs, which are pulmonary embolisms, so like blood clots in the heart, blockages in the blood vessels that supply your lungs. It's just a very dangerous situation.
Nice save.
Thank you.
Students also practice their skills at Drexel's Simulation Center. There, technician Diana Alberti operates a high-tech dummy called Simman.
I don't feel well.
The mannequin, I mean, it's kind of awkward looking, and everyone gets frightened by the first time that it blinks.
Alberti can program Simman to have all sorts of heart problems.
Oh, I can't breathe and my chest hurts. Help.
If the students are feeling the pulse, it picks up on that and records it, things like that.
The mannequin knows when it's being touched?
Yes, it's wireless, and it has a ton of different sensors that can track different things.
Newbies like first-year student Mazier Shakari can poke and prod around without worrying about hurting a real person. It's his very first time in the sim lab, and he just recently learned how to wear his stethoscope correctly.
I kept putting it on backwards.
He's got it on right now and leans over to listen to the mannequin's chest.
So I definitely hear something that's not normal. And so instead of hearing that strong dub, you actually hear kind of like a whoosh sound.
Final answer.
Final answer. I would say possibly a...
No one's grading you.
I know, I'm not. Exactly. I'd say possibly mitral regurge. I'm not entirely sure.
Actually, it's a mitral stenosis. Technician Diana Alberti says he heard the problem at the right spot, but not the right kind of abnormality.
You look like you're a little embarrassed that you got it wrong, but you're able to hear the difference. This is, I would consider, a success for you.
Which is to say, at first, it's hard to hear clearly. Here's another hint from Alberti.
When you're trying to build your skills in being able to hear and identify different heart sounds, it helps to, when you're just listening to music, to try and pick out the different instruments, and specifically the bass. So it's that background noise that often gets tucked behind the drums or the guitar. And when you can pick that out easily, it kind of helps. It correlates to your ability to pick out that faint sound against all the other noises in a room and inside the body when you're listening to the heart.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Coming up, life-changing moments.
It started snowing around 7 o'clock at night.
I realized that I had started early labor.
And I began to feel really ill.
And things got a little crazy from there.
The baby's coming now! Take off my pants!
Still to come on The Pulse, stay tuned to WHYY. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Actively supporting nonprofit organizations that increase disease awareness, prevention, and access to medicines in the Philadelphia region, AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. Learn more by visiting AstraZeneca-US.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. We're listening to some of our favorite moments from the show today, and right now, a look at life-changing moments where everything is different in an instant. Alana Gordon produced this story of a man who overdosed on heroin and came back from the dead.
The last time I was on your guys' station, it was for a couple bank robberies. You guys ran the story when I got caught in 2005. My name is John Dooling. I'm 36. The last time I used heroin, I died. I started drinking and smoking weed at about 14, and guys I grew up around were doing heroin. So about 15, 16, I wanted to be cool with them, so I started doing it. Heroin made me feel perfect. Heroin led me to losing my job, my apartment. I didn't have any anxiety. I was homeless, started getting in trouble, started getting arrested. It made me feel good. Started going to jail. And that's one thing that I never really felt. I went to prison, they had drugs. That wears off and you chase that. Act of desperation. And you just get caught up and then you lose yourself and it takes your soul. I did 5 years. My whole incarceration, I kind of wanted to be sober, get my life together. I had a game plan, like things I wanted to do when I got out. It was July 15th, 2012. The situation for me was I had 4 months clean. So there was no opiates in my system. You think you can shoot like, you know, where you were before. I was at my friend's house, and we were just kicking it. We got some money up. We really wanted to get high. We got high in the parking lot, and everything was cool. And I remember sitting at his table eating sherbet. I shot those last two bags. I was just sitting at the table with my boy. It was abrupt. Laughing, eating sherbet. It was like a comfortable dream. I just nodded out. Like how when you stand up too quick. And he said my whole face turned blue and my lips turned purple. And you see like all the dots. It was like that. It was bright. He tried to do something. There was paramedics, police, and nurses around. I felt like I was going somewhere. There was kind of like a map in front of me. And there was like a line. I was going. A red line in between. I was moving to a different point. And then, I was going, kind of behind it. It was like I was on a turnpike, and like exits were flying by. I was going. It was like I was driving somewhere. Like there was a destination I was going to reach. I was going. I was going. All those white lights. They hit me with Narcan. Just like waking up, there was paramedics, police, and nurses. When they started talking to me, it kind of sounded like the Peanuts teacher. After about a minute and that stuff like wore off, I felt sick. They were like, "Are you okay? Do you know your name? Do you know what year it is? Do you know who the president is?" Just kind of stopped them and was just like, "Yo, hand me that trash can, I'm gonna throw up." Started throwing up. Immediately went into withdrawal. I said a bunch of foul things. They told me that I died for about 7 minutes. I died for like 7 minutes, and I was lucky to be alive. I definitely was dead. There was 4 other people that overdosed that night, and they all died except me and somebody else. I think it saved my life.
John Dooling has been in recovery since then and now works as a wellness advocate at Brandywine Counseling in Delaware. This piece was part of our series, Patient Files. There are moments in our lives that we know we'll never forget. Even as we live through them, we know that whatever is happening right now will be part of our narrative, part of what defines us. J.J. Shirley and Raphael Cunniff lived through such a major moment when their son Declan was born. It was a winter evening. It had started to snow heavily when J.J.'s labor pains began. At that same time, Raphael started to come down with a vicious stomach virus. J.J. had long labors with her two older sons, so she figured she had plenty of time and could wait for the snow to stop and for Raphael to get better.
So I got in bed and sort of half slept through contractions, more or less, for maybe an hour or so.
I had the shakes and I was in and out of the bathroom quite a bit. I certainly couldn't have gone anywhere.
And then I got up and I got sick. And I thought, okay, now we have to go. We're done. We got to go now. Unfortunately, he had stopped shivering, although I don't think he felt very good.
I was like, this is just, it's snowing now. There's like a couple inches of snow on the ground. I'm incredibly ill. I'm like, JJ, just don't be in labor. Stop that.
I was giving directions to my mom because I hadn't packed the last few things, like, you know, my toothbrush and stuff. And so in between contractions, I'm like, Mom, get toothbrush, bathroom. Okay, get this. You know, I basically sounded like a hippo. You know, that like horrible, like really guttural, like animal sound that you make when you're in late stage labor. We started to come down the stairs, you know, slowly in between contractions. And we got to the bottom of the stairs and my water broke.
My mom said, call 911. So I go to the kitchen because it's far too loud where we were. And I start calling 911 and I say, you know, we're having a baby here, I think. And they say, well, when are you going to have the baby? I'm like, probably right now. And they're like, okay. And then walked back into our hall where the stairs are and hear that the baby's being born. JJ says, the baby's coming now. The baby's coming now. And my mom, who is behind her, sort of acting as a birthing stool, says, no, 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 you don't need to push. She's like, no, the baby's coming now. Take off my pants. She's wearing her pajama pants. And so we're struggling to rip off her pajama pants. And as we take off her pajama pants, the baby's head is crowned, you know, fully crowned.
Raphael fortunately remembered from our refresher class that you have to check for the umbilical cord. If you're in a situation where the baby's being born without any medical attention, check to make sure the umbilical cord isn't, you know, wrapped around the neck, which fortunately, no, it wasn't. It wasn't wrapped around your neck, so that was good. And then it was maybe, yeah, two more pushes, and he was out. He was born right into Raphael's feverish hands.
Yeah. We waited for the ambulance that arrived about a minute after Declan was born, and he was still attached with his umbilical cord. JJ was wrapped in her in a white comforter, just having given birth to Declan, holding him wrapped in towels in her arms. The paramedics are walking out the door, and JJ's walking out the door, and opening those doors right there, those double doors, and the snow. And the blood, the snow, the white comforter, and the blood. It was like a scene from The Shining.
J.J. Shirley and Raphael Cunniff describing the birth of their son, Declan.
We spent a couple of days in the hospital, not necessarily expecting to, but we were so tired. And I was just laying on a cot. And the hospital was like, I think you should admit me.
And finally, a lovely moment to end today's show on. Just by chance and good fortune, reporter Alana Gordon came across Linda Wang. She's a medical student from Canada who loves jazz, and when Linda sees a piano, she plays it. Thankfully, Alana had her recorder with her.
So I'm sitting in the lobby of the Perelman Center for Advanced Medicine, apparently, of the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. I saw that someone was playing it, and you know, it just said on the sign that you could check in with the information desk to play, and they said sure. So It's been a really good afternoon. I basically do this whenever I have a break. So, you know, often the hospitals have a piano in the lobby, and when I'm on call and I don't have a patient to see, I usually just go and play for a while.
That's the way it goes some days. A fever comes at you without a warning.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, Meg Pinto, our executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show, any of our previous shows? Subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And that's also where you can get in touch with us. Send us your emails, your questions, your feedback. We always love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
I told you that I love you. Please believe.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.